morning, everyone. I'm Ellen Eisman, who with double pride has the pleasure of serving as a board member of this beautiful historic library, which some of you may not know was effectively the nation's Library of Congress during President George Washington's tenure when New York was our capital. And as a longtime friend, indeed we go back to the sandbox of our distinguished speaker, Buzz Bissinger. For me, it has been a delight over the decades to witness Buzz's professional growth and to watch him gain stature in the world of sports and journalism. He won a Pulitzer for his book exploring corruption in the court system of his hometown, Philly, and he has never, as you will hear later tonight, hesitated to take on controversial subjects. Buzz's most popular book, Friday Night Lights, which was turned into a movie and television series, at first brought him death threats in Odessa, Texas, when he settled into the town with his family, where he undertook his reporting on a town whose values he felt were skewed toward football triumph at the expense of all else. Buzz has written four books and scores of articles for the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and an array of other publications. He now has a regular column in the New Republic on topics spanning baseball, football, basketball, politics, journalistic ethics, and more, always opining with a strong voice, a fresh angle, a special way with words, and a great deal of irony. I could go on describing Buzz's rich background, but better he start his talk, after which he'll take 15 minutes of questions. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Buzz Bissinger, my very cherished and very accomplished friend.
I've done a lot of these, but I finally figured it out, you just invite everybody you know. And this is pretty much everybody I know. So it's pretty full. That's good. It is wonderful to be here. There are a lot of familiar faces, a lot of old friends, particularly a lot of people from Dalton, where I went to school. Ellen and I really did know each other since the sandbox. I'm not sure why I became a writer. I think it had a lot to do with growing up in New York and loving newspapers. But I actually now think Ellen is responsible. When I was five, I was kind of a quirky, strange kid. I didn't talk. I ate meals with marbles in my mouth, once with safety pins, which didn't bother my mother. In any case, I had a birthday party, and I was very quiet and very inward, and I had gotten this beautiful zebra placemat. And I loved it. It was mine. Ellen took it, used it, spilled milk on it. I burst into tears and went and hid in the closet. And it's then at the age of five I said, I have to do something else productive with my life. So I decided to become a writer. The real reason I did become a journalist was I was lucky. I grew up in the heyday of newspapers in New York. There must have been, I don't know, six, seven, eight different newspapers. There was a newsstand at 86 in Central Park West. It was just, I fell in love with them. I adored the smell of them, the feel of them, the look of them. They dazzled me, they amazed me because of the way they came out every day. My uncle Jim, who was here tonight, was a seminal influence from his work at the Philippian, the paper at Andover. The Bernsteins are here, and I have vivid memories of what it was like when information and newspapers counted. I remember during the summer, it was the summer of Watergate, and every morning we could not get enough of what was in the New York Times, and then we could not get enough of the hearings that went on for hour after hour after hour. And we were all mesmerized, fascinated, cared, because we were witnessing history and also, in a sense, witnessing and feeling and hearing the incredible flow of information. Certainly, I think a tremendous amount of that has changed today. I am outspoken, and the last time I talked about sports journalism, changes in sports journalism and the impact of bloggers in particular, I made the unfortunate choice of doing it on national television on the Bob Costas show on HBO. I have a sense some of you may have seen it. Bob was holding a very public forum on this very subject, the influence of the internet, the influence of sports blogs, the influence of websites, the way in which print journalism is changing. It was before a live audience and viewers of several million. And it was a fascinating, important subject matter, except for the fact that I pretty much had a psychotic breakdown in public, and I really did. I mean, I got very impassioned. I got very angry. I was debating with a young man named Will Leach, who's actually a very nice kid, and I feel proud that I'm responsible for the incredible uplift of his career. I certainly made him what he was. He was a nobody before I vilified him. He was the founder of a website called Deadspin. I don't know how many here have actually looked at Deadspin. Deadspin is a very popular sports website. It is sometimes funny, but it's often vindictive, cruel, and nasty, like many of these blogs and websites are, particularly the comment section. I won't go into what they called me afterwards. But Will Leach was nice. He was a nice kid. But given my genuine suspicion of sports blogging, as I say, its frequent dedication to cruelty and misinformation and disinformation and public embarrassment of sports figures and sports writers and whatever, and postings, and one of the worst things about blogs is they don't believe in editors, they go on for days, they're poorly written. Not everyone in life was meant to be a writer, but the internet has changed that. So I really bit into him. I'm sure many of you have seen Raging Bull, but I really was worse than Jake LaMotta. It was an awful performance. At the time, I thought it was proud of myself, and then I came home and asked my wife how I did, and she said, don't even ask. And I'm hoping that none of you, if you haven't seen it, will see it. However, if you Google my name, it is the first thing that comes up, and it is on YouTube. And it may be the only time in my life that I'm glad, rest their souls, that my parents are dead. I was genuinely angry. I was genuinely aggressive. What I did to Will Leach was wrong. I was crude, and I was rude, and I was abrasive. But I did act with a genuine passion, which I am beginning to think is really a mistake in today's culture. I believe that. I said what I felt, what I truly felt, no spin, which I think is an even bigger mistake today. I have learned that some blogs, sports blogs, whatever, are quite good. In the world of sports, Bill Simmons is very entertaining. Henry Abbott knows a tremendous amount about the NBA. I don't know why anyone would want to know anything about the NBA, but he does know a lot about the NBA. But these two also work under the umbrella of a major media organization, which is ESPN. There is an adherence to standards. Most blogs, first of all, are only read by one, the person who wrote them. But most have no adherence to standards. Most, as I say, rely on information, ironically, from newspapers that they detest and they hate. And they vilify and they do no reporting of their own. And that's the fear that I have, that what they do will become the norm, because it is increasingly becoming the norm. I have been outspoken in my beliefs, and I am one of those people. First of all, I'm incredibly negative. People from Dalton will attest. I don't see the glass as half full or half empty. The fucking thing broke long ago. No one will dispute that. But I can say I think we are headed and may already be in terrible trouble. At the very least, we are headed, and maybe it will head in the right direction, because we do not know. We are moving at the speed of sound because of technology, because of the internet, because of the way communications are today. We are certainly headed for a completely unknowable and uncertain future. And probably as a nation in the past, I heard my grandmother talk about it and my parents, there is always this nostalgia for the good old days. We probably felt the same thing about the radio when it was invented, and then we felt the same thing about television. But there is one statistic that I find truly amazing. It took roughly 38 years for radio to have a billion listeners. It took television about 14 years. It took Facebook about 2 years to have a billion hits, It took Apple 9 months to have a billion people buy their applications. That's how fast we are moving. It is at the speed of sound. What does it all mean? It certainly means that all forms of media, whether it's books, whether it's newspapers, whether it's magazines, whether it's movies, we are in for profound change. Change we cannot fathom. All distributions, all ways of communication are changing as we know. Will it be e-books for books? What is happening to a magazine industry that I work for, whether it's Vanity Fair or the New Republic or the New York Times, in which advertising is substantially down? At Vanity Fair, it's down 25%. What will they look like? What will they be? Will they survive? Movies, DVD sales are flat. It's over. That era is over. What is distribution going to be like? Who is going to distribute it? How important is Comcast going to be because it is now buying NBC and Universal? But the most vulnerable of all of these entities, I believe, is the print paper. I have no doubt about that. Print journalism is sacred to me. I grew up with it. I loved it. Every member of my family had a different paper that they loved, whether it was the Herald Tribune or the New York Times. What did Uncle Winky read? Something weird. Well, the Post, that's right. Trust me, if you have an uncle named Uncle Winky, he reads the Post. But it was sacred to me. It was something I truly knew I wanted to be when I was 12 years old. It was sacred to me not because of the things that it taught me to become a writer of books and magazines later in life. It was a wonderful era. I started in 1976. It was the height of Watergate. Every paper, I started at the Norfolk Ledger Star. They wanted investigative reporting. They had rookie reporters like myself doing 100-inch stories. Right from the beginning, you were learning about narrative and plot and developing character. And it was filled with funky characters, saints and sinners and drunks, and people who were brilliant and still had it, and people who were brilliant and had lost it. Newsrooms were weird. They had rats. But they were these hodgepodge and wonderful places of electric energy. They were great places to work, unlike today, where they are basically depopulated. But I also sincerely believe that journalism, print journalism, it is one of the key underpinnings of our democracy, and a lot of people say that. It doesn't mean that everyone has to agree with what's in a newspaper. I've been on the wrong end of many, many stories that people have done on me. Some reporters are woefully sloppy, perhaps more pernicious. Some reporters go into stories, as we know, with preconceived notions of what they're going to write about, what that slant will be, and then selectively use the facts to fit that template. Fortunately, it's something I have never done myself, except when I have to. I believe the New York Times is still an exceptional paper. But even the New York Times, if I read one more of their national trend stories that is basically based on two anecdotes and that old reliable trick known as an exponential rise in statistics, since two events plus two events equals 100% increase, I am going to have to demand a refund. They do these things constantly, but they do a tremendous amount right. The bravery of their reporters, whether it's at the Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Los Angeles Times or the Washington Post, the bravery of these reporters, whether it's in Iraq or Israel or the Gaza Strip or Palestine or Afghanistan or Pakistan or the Congo or Rwanda, is both exceptional to me and a tremendous source of pride. I am a coward. I know many colleagues who are not. And I believe it isn't necessarily an adrenaline rush that propels them. I believe it is that old adage that no one remembers anymore, the public's right to know. The good news is newspapers from Philadelphia, from the Philadelphia Inquirer, which is my paper, my hometown, to the New York Times, to the Washington Post, there is still enterprise and investigative reporting being done. There are many editors who, despite incredibly depleted resources, decimated newsrooms, owners and publishers who have turned into complete pricks, the work is still being done. And in the world of sports, there is no more shining example than the marvelous work done, which I think many of you read, by Alan Schwartz of the New York Times, in writing away and pounding away at this hideous hidden epidemic of head injuries in pro football, where you have men who sacrifice their life to the game, who are basically told after 6-7 concussions, if you don't get your ass back in there, you're going to be off the team, who are threatened. Remember John Mackey, great tight end for the Baltimore Colts? Has anyone seen the video of John Mackey? Has anyone read the story about John Mackey? He's 50 years old. He is in a nursing home with a feral teammate with total Alzheimer's at the age of 50. He does not know where he is. He does not know who he is. And the two of them sit together with no memory of even where they played football. There's early dementia. There's life cut off at the age of 50. There was even suicide. And it was the work of Alan Schwartz, bit by bit, endlessly, exhaustively, who has exposed this. And finally, the league, after constant denials that there are no studies to prove that concussions are dangerous, is now changing its policy. That's great reporting. So I guess the fundamental question tonight is whether, in a sense, as we talk about the future in particular of journalism, print journalism, can that type of reporting, can it be transferred to this thing called the internet? I really blew it on the internet because I always thought the revolution of the internet would be in the world of commerce and business. It would be easier to buy things, easier to buy books, easier to buy wine, easier to buy clothing. That certainly is a component. But the revolution is the way it has changed communications, the way we think, the way we act, the way we interact, and what we care about. And it is unstoppable. It is going to transfer into that direction. Many people, for some reason, have said, you're remarkably cranky for a 55-year-old man. I am cranky. I am. And I am angry, and I suppose I'm old school or old fart or whatever they call me on the web every time I write something. But my 18-year-old son, who is a freshman at Kenyon, is not old school. He's hip. He believes in current events, and he actually knows quite a bit about them, and I'm proud of him for that. He loves a very good internet site called The Beast, The Daily Beast, which I'm sure some of you have read, which is quite good, Tina Brown, although it's fishing money. But I can also tell you I've never, ever seen him pick up a newspaper in his life. Everything he gets, like most kids that we have, is off his computer. Everything, sports, news, politics, everything. And I remember it was an innocent question. I asked him, are you going to bring a television to college? He said, what for? I don't need a TV. Nobody needs a TV, Dad. Get with it. We can get everything we want off the computer, legally or illegally. And that's a fundamental change. You know, I'm not a soothsayer. I'm a journalist. I'm not a publisher. I'm not one of these futurists. I don't know what the hell they are anyway. Shysters, really. Well, they are. No one really knows what is going to happen despite what they may lead you to think. I don't know if anyone read, I just read it, the recent piece in the New York Review of Books about the future of the bookness by Jason Epstein, which in addition to be unbelievably overwritten was virtually incomprehensible. And it was. The one thing that does give me hope about print journalism, and I mean this, that it will survive, have been all the facile, poorly reported stories using the same tired sources saying that it will never survive. Because when reporters en masse certify a trend and write about it endlessly, much like they wrote about the housing boom, you could pretty much bet the opposite is occurring. It is much like the way I invest, frankly. My broker's here tonight. What have you done for me lately? The minute I get into something that I consider exotic, which is like a hedge fund, I instinctively know that ship has already sailed. But I do it anyway because I don't want to be left out. And then I get killed and I do what everyone should do. I blame my broker. So you fucked up on that. The greatest concern I have, and it is a grave one, is what studies have shown about that transition from print to internet, because it is coming. It is coming. Every study is beyond dismal. Newspapers made a fatal mistake. Perhaps it was an understandable mistake. They banked that there would be a boom in revenue from web advertising, and they made this fatal decision to give away the product for free on the basis that you would get all these eyeballs, so to speak, and all these hits, and that would get you advertising. The predictions were incredibly overblown. I think web advertising accounts, and I may be off a little bit, at most, for 10% of a newspaper's revenue. Then they lost classified advertising to Craigslist, because any kid under the age of 25 will never, ever look in a newspaper classified. They will immediately go to Craigslist. They have now created this literally absurd situation of wanting people to pay for a product that they can and do get for free. It is a terrible model. And the other problem is a simple problem of human nature. Once you give away something for free, it is almost impossible to get it back in the box, to get people to pay for it. I think they resent it. The one possible shot that they have had recently would have been for all publishers, and there was talk about this, regardless of antitrust or anything else, all publishers, yes, to collude, to get together, every publisher at the stroke of 12:01 a.m. on January, or whatever, March 1st or April 1st says, that's it. Everyone, every newspaper, we are charging for web content. They all do it at the same time. They all cut off their free access to the web. But publishers cannot agree on anything. So it has not happened, and it will not happen. That kind of instantaneous, this is how it's going to be. Everyone is freelancing. A few sobering facts that I find terrifying as it applies to the future of print news and to the future of print of sports journalism and all journalism. Several months ago, Newsday instituted a policy of charging $5 a month for access to its web content. They spent, I heard, $4 to $5 million to redesign their website to make it as attractive as possible to readers. The result, web traffic went down 41%. The number of people who actually signed up, 35. What is that, $175? This was truly pathetic, but the Miami Herald was so desperate, it started something called the tip jar. They would actually leave tip jars around Miami so readers could put money in the tip jar to help the sagging revenues of the Miami Herald. I mean, you got to be fucking kidding me that they thought that would work. Suffice to say, that model has been scrapped as well. At the New York Times, everyone is waiting with a lot of anticipation, really, because it is the Times. The Times sets the table. And by the way, the Times website is fantastic. The Times does many, many things right. But everyone is waiting, because they are going to do it sometime within the next several months, to use a metered system of payment, basically in which readers, if they go on the web, will be required to pay after a certain number of free peeks at stories, they will be required to pay for stories. But they also tried something similar before when they charged for premium content, such as columnists, the Maureen Dowds and the Tom Friedmans and whatever, and it failed, and they had to give it away for free again. In general, when polled, and I think this poll is probably accurate, close to 80% said they would not pay for content that once was given out for free. They also said in the same poll, it was also close to 80%, why pay anything for content, no matter what the source, since so much of it is already out there for free? You can get it anywhere, anywhere. You can go on a dozen different news sites. I have an iPhone. They have all these RSS news feeds. You can break down the firewall of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and you have Google News. It is all over the place. And people have said, if we can get it for free, we don't care how good it is, we don't want it. So what does it mean? It means to me that the transition of newspapers, because they were transitioning, because print is dying, circulation is down, advertising is down, classifieds are down, part of it is the economy, but part of it, and it's not really us, it's our kids, part of it is people don't want to hold a newspaper. They don't believe in it. One of the most distressing things that I see is that I write a column for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and all these papers do this. I don't know why they do it. They allow readers to comment, but they never comment on the story. Most of it is abusive. Most of it, a lot of it is racist. A lot of it is incredibly personal. I mean, some woman said I just looked like Leona Helmsley, for God's sakes. And I wrote her back, and I said, if that's the best insult you can give me, go screw yourself. I did. But the worst thing is how many people say with glee, I cannot wait until the Philadelphia Inquirer fails. I cannot wait until it falls. I cannot wait until your paper dries up. When I had all this flack with the bloggers on Costas, I got literally 1,000 emails, and hundreds said, we don't care about newspapers. Newspapers are old-fashioned. Screw newspapers. We cannot wait until you fail and you all go out of business. Now, maybe I am too negative, because you know what? There were once trolley cars in every city. Things do change, and we cannot predict change. And habits do change over time, and they are changing. And frankly, the most interesting perspective, and I mean it, comes from someone like Ben Diamond, who is here, or Alex, Ellen's son, because they are the future. Or Emily, you guys are the future. But equally problematic is what has already happened to newspapers on the print side because of massive cuts and layoffs. Because what happens is the first to go, if they can, and they do, we saw it at the Boston Globe, the unions had to cave in and give up seniority. The first to go are the oldest and often most experienced reporters. Yes, some of them are burned out. Some of them were burned out years ago. I remember at the Inquirer, there were reporters who literally hid in closets. You would not see them for years. But a lot of them were great and had the institutional memory of the city. They knew it backwards and forwards. They knew who every person was. They knew where every body was buried and unburied. They're all gone. They are all gone. And why are they cut? Because they're too expensive. They make too much, and their benefits are too high. So they're completely lopped off. So experience, institutional memory, which is crucial at any organization, is lost. The number of reporters lost in newspapers since 2001, 13,000, or 22%. The next thing that's cut after your experienced reporters, investigative units. New publisher comes in, like Sam Zell, who's terrifying, obviously. He says, what are you guys doing? Why is it taking all this time? There's some publishers who want now to pay reporters, not on the basis of a salary, but literally by how many words they produce. a year. But they look at these investigative units. Why is it taking so much time? Why is it so hard? What's the problem? Why aren't you more productive? Where's the story? They are considered useless, useless, and a waste of time. So they're gone. They get cut. And what is happening on the print side? And then you have this terrible, terrible tension. Problems on the print side and problems even if they transition to the website. What is happening as, I guess he is a media futurist, but supposedly legitimate one. I have read his stuff and he's pretty smart. His name is Ken Doctor. He used to be with Knight Ridder. What you have happening, as he put it, is, quote, truly local news, our supply lines are being cut. Less reporters, less investigative reporters, less reporters who know their city and know their place. And so investigative reporting, it's almost obsolete now. And if it has to shift over to the web, I don't see it. Now, maybe in the future, the Bens and the Alexes will, and maybe they will adapt to this. But it seems to me the internet, what's fun about it, it's about speed. It is about surfing. It's about going to this site and this site and this page and that page. You dance all around from site to site. You pick up a tidbit here, a tidbit there. Something catches your eye for a while, but you're moving all the time. It's very, very fast-paced. Reading a long story of 5 or 6 or 7,000 words on a computer screen is very, very difficult, and I don't think that, frankly, as a nation, frankly, that many of us, sadly, in this country, have the attention span to do it or have the inclination to do it. So I think it's going to be a very, very rough transition, in addition to the fact that newspapers are looking down the road of an incredible dwindling loss of revenues. Perhaps the most pressing problem for me today is what people think of as news. Because of the net, and the net is about freedom, everyone can be a writer. Everyone does have a right to write. I guess that's beautiful in a sense, except most people, as I say, cannot write. But they have that shot. But what is distressing is what people constitute as news. Because I don't think they want news anymore. I think they want things that only shape and conform to their opinions and their views. News, yes. Objectivity is wobbly. There is no such thing as objectivity. The first word you pick in a sentence is subjective. But there is an attempt to have balance. People don't want that. They want their views certified. And I wonder, do we really care about facts anymore? Do we? Do we as a nation? Is it simply ignorance? Or is it simply that we now have a repository of places to go that will prove every viewpoint, everything that Glenn Beck says, everything that Sarah Palin says, everything that every wingnut says? And look at it, look at it, look at the insanity. Now, you can debate all along about health care and whether the bill is good or bad, and I frankly don't know enough. But we all saw these incredible protests, these town hall meetings where these idiots were carrying pictures of Obama looking like Hitler, which also means they know nothing about history, nothing, nothing. To compare Obama to a man who killed not only 7 million Jews, but literally 40 million people. But the idiocy was, they say, we don't want government in our health care. And somebody says, what is Medicare? It's a government program. And they say, no, it's not. And they prove it. It is. It's a government program. And they do not listen. And they will not listen. And that's, to me, where the danger of this thing called blogs, of these certain websites, that, to me, is the ultimate danger. Yes, some are well-written. Some are based on misinformation. I overstated on Costas. Yes, there are some dedicated to the facts. There are actually some that have reporting staffs, but very few. But many are dedicated, really, to edge and opinion and proving, as I say, a specific viewpoint. dispassion, balance, which most reputable journalists, I believe, try to practice even when it's hard, even when it's difficult to screen out. They don't practice. When I had my unfortunate meltdown on Costas, and it really was an embarrassment to me that did not help my career, frankly, it hurt it. The one thing that struck me the most about what Will Leach said, and he's a very talented guy. And interestingly enough, he's left the world of blogs and he's joined the dark side because he now writes for a print publication, New York Magazine. But the one thing he said that I found interesting and intriguing and insightful about where we are going, he said, look, even if bloggers had access to baseball clubhouses and football locker rooms, we wouldn't go. We don't want to go because we'll get co-opted. These are places of propaganda. These are places that only propagate the company line. So we don't want to go. We want to stand back and form our own opinions. And that's fine, and that's true. And yes, everyone is trying to spin everyone. Everyone. It has been ever thus. But in my experience, good reporters use these places, whether it's a clubhouse, whether it's a business boardroom, whatever it is, whether it's a publishing house, whatever it is, whether it's a brokerage house, whether it's the White House, good reporters use these places and go to these places to develop sources, to go underneath, to find who is speaking BS and to find who is really speaking closer to the truth. They are used as tools to find out what is really going on and what can be substantiated and what cannot. And bloggers, many, they don't do that, and nor do they believe in it. And so we are left to endless speculation and opinion based, really, on nothing. It is another of my greatest fears that in this culture of ignorance, in which we really, truly seem to revel in today, in which it almost seems, whether you like the Tea Party or not, their brilliance has been, they have made a college, not having a college degree, a badge of courage. That means you're real. That means you're real American. You went to Yale, you went to Harvard, even if you went to Penn. You're an elitist. You're not an American. You're not a real American. You don't understand this country. They have somehow made it this badge of courage not to care about facts, not to read, not to want to know what's going on unless it certifies their own views. The only place they think it's legitimate to have a college degree is from some place in Idaho, which has the most right-wing wingnuts in the country, like Sarah Palin. As I said, after my appearance on Costas, I got hundreds of responses from bloggers. Some of them were very articulate. Some of them were actually very nice. Many of them were very nice. Some of them were not so nice. And I understood the vitriol. I had insulted them. But as I said, what was most distressing, and I think it's become part of sort of the public cry now, because we are an elite group, is the sense we cannot wait until the print newspaper dies. It's obsolete, it's old hat, it's old fashioned. Bissinger, you're an old fart, go away. So what does it potentially mean? It means to me that superb reporting on head injuries that really expose a crippling problem, a problem that is called early Alzheimer's, that is called literally death or suicide, will no longer exist. No resources, plus you won't be able to read it. You won't want to read it if it's solely on the web. The kind of things, the kind of stories that we have read that have exposed injustice, the kind of things that got me into journalism, which is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. I think that those types of stories. And yes, they do take months. They sometimes take years. And trust me, having done them, they are not fun to do. They're laborious. They're endless. They're painstaking. They're difficult. They're frustrating. But they are worth doing. I think in our society, they may be dead. They may be obsolete. So what can be done? I'm never very good at this because I don't really know what can be done. I'm not very good at predicting or saying or having solutions. I do know that there are print newspapers and there are publishers out there that are staying the course, that are dedicated. The irony is, despite what Wall Street thinks, because Wall Street is one of the big players in this and basically has given up on newspaper companies as being obsolete. Many big city newspapers actually are still profitable. It is not the great days of the 10 to 15% that many big city newspapers made or medium-sized papers made of 20 to 25%. But they are profitable. But I also point to the example of my home paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer. The Inquirer is in bankruptcy like many papers have been in. But the paper, in terrible economic conditions, as we all know, did squeeze out a profit of $15 million in a terrible economy. It did make some money. Unfortunately, because it is in bankruptcy proceedings, it has to pay both sides of the legal and professional fees. It has been in bankruptcy for a year. Both sides have admitted for the past 6 months, because an issue is on appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, both sides have admitted that the bankruptcy has stalled and is going nowhere. Despite that, the legal and professional fees for 1 year in a bankruptcy that is going nowhere has been $26 million. $26 million. So there's no profit. There's a $10 million loss. And it's absurd. It is absurd. But I can tell you, the Inquirer, much to my shock, is a better paper than it was 2 years ago. Much to my surprise, it has a publisher who I did not believe in, who has hired some terrific people who are dedicated and care, and they have produced some wonderful, wonderful journalism. Another possible alternative that some newspapers have successfully done is to have foundations enter the picture, nonprofit foundations, and take over the operation of newspapers with the right protections and walls of separation so as not to influence the news. That has worked until recently because of the economy, certainly in St. Pete and the St. Petersburg Times. It's different now because of the economy, but the St. Pete paper, owned by a nonprofit, the Poynter Institute, was for years the best writer's paper in the country and produced a wonderful, wonderful slew of reporters who went on to other papers, whether it was the Times or the Post, or wrote marvelous books and won Pulitzers. That is another possibility. None of these are great suggestions, and they certainly are not original ones. But I can say this because I know this. If we lose the role of newspaper as watchdog, because it is our watchdog, it is our final line of defense against the wanton corruption that increasingly defines our country. If we lose investigative reporting, and frankly, a lot of our investigative reporting has not been recently been very good, but if we lose it, if we lose that investigative reporting, we lose a linchpin, I think, of what makes this country so special and so different. But maybe the biggest savior of all for print newspapers is simply this. All blogs depend on them, whether it's the Huffington Post or the Daily Beast. They all depend on newspapers for their information. So if we don't exist, if there are no newspapers, what the hell are they going to write about? So maybe in the end, that will be our only and our greatest savior. Thank you. Now, I'm happy to take questions about anything or everything. My childhood, who I had a crush on, Annie Murphy, but it didn't work out. Sure. Yes, sir. That's my broker, by the way. No, I don't think it did. There was a book review in the New York Times. The columnist, Russ, I can't pronounce his last name, Duhat or. Anyway, there was a book review in the New York Times. I forget who it was. He was an academic. One of the big movements now on the internet is to get rid of copyright laws. That all content should be free, including books. Well, I mean, if that's the case, there will be no authors because there will be no way of making any money. There won't be if you cannot protect your own work. Anyway, he disagreed with that, and he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying this was crazy. Copyright must exist. Authors must have that protection, both because it is their work and also for their livelihood. And he must have gotten 10,000 different emails just crucifying him. Anyway, there was a book review written, and the first paragraph was the book review, is the unfortunate thing about people who have taken on blogs and taken on the internet, this is what ultimately they're remembered for, like Buzz Bissinger, who was remembered much more by young journalists and readers for what he said on Bob Costas than writing Friday Night Lights. And I actually think that's true. I think that's true. I just think that's among young people what I will be known for. I cannot tell, but this old, angry fart who broke down on national television. Now, I may be wrong. So I don't think it helped, and I don't think the conduct, the way I acted was under any conditions. I don't think other people should be treated that way. I was way over the top and way too inflamed, and what could have been an interesting discussion devolved into really stupidity. You know, I could lie like most people do when they give speeches and try to act as if I do. I don't. My sense is Europe, the tradition of reading a newspaper is much bigger in Europe than it is here. Now, Europe, a lot of the papers are, which is actually the way it was here. My wife and I were discussing this. You know, the real heyday of newspapers in America was probably not until the 1960s, I think, when the Vietnam War began to be covered. Of course, a lot of newspapers in Europe are party newspapers or political newspapers. But there is you go into Europe, you go into any city, you'll see 8 or 9 newspapers. Now, I don't know what kind of pressures they're dealing with in terms of declining circulation and what kind of pressures they're dealing with in terms of web content and giving it away for free. I assume they're having similar problems. But I do think there's a greater tradition of reading newspapers, and I think there's a greater tradition of reading books as well. But I really don't know. It's just all impression. Sure. Organizations are finding that it just doesn't work. I don't think the public cares, though. I mean, I think academics may be different because I think the feeling is these are for-profit institutions, newspapers. They do make money. They're traded publicly on the stock exchange. I've heard, you know, in a sense, although it was silly, it was the Miami Herald putting out the tip jar. Now, you could do it in a much better way, but the sense was this is at least the reader showing us that we are important. And I don't think people – first of all, I think many people, for whatever reason, don't like newspapers. They don't agree with them. They don't agree with their political viewpoints. Certainly the conservative movement, which seems to be getting stronger and stronger, thinks that most papers are too biased and too liberal. And I don't think that argument will work. And then I think they'll go on the web and they say, well, you know what? First of all, I don't like the New York Times. Second of all, I don't like to read that much. I can read a two-paragraph or three-paragraph synopsis on Google and Yahoo, or I can go on CNN, or I can, you know, go on YouTube and get what I need. I just don't think that argument that this costs money, that this is important, and I agree with you, is going to work. I just do not, because they, you know, they are for-profit institutions. Maybe they would feel differently if they weren't, but they are, and I just don't think that argument's going to work. I just don't. I really don't. Good.
I consider myself your more positive alter ego for 55 years, so I'll play that.
That's true.
And this is from the experience of where I live in New Haven, Connecticut, which is a small city, which for most of the 20th century had, really for the whole 20th century virtually, had a family-owned newspaper, a classic model. The difference from the experience of New Haven compared to what you're describing in Philadelphia, New York, Washington, is that the newspaper was always terrible. It never did justice to the community. It never covered the community well. And when it got sold in the 1980s to a succession of other companies, it only got worse. What we have in New Haven today, we still have the Register, and it's worse than it's ever been. And we have a terrific nonprofit online newspaper, which does an absolutely spectacularly good job of covering the community, in my opinion, which has the institutional memory that you were talking about, because it's run by a guy who's been doing journalism in our community for 25 years. These experienced reporters from various places are being paid $35,000 and $40,000 a year to ply their trade. And I would add that this is called the New Haven Independent. It's an online paper. You should look at it, everybody. But it's the business. There is no business model. They struggle to pull their pennies together to pay their staff, you know, a pittance. So the business model is completely broken. It's supported by Foundation I run. It's supported by the Knight Foundation, which is a big player in this nationally. But it's much better journalism, local community journalism, much better, including investigative journalism, than the New Haven Register ever was. The last thing I would say about it is that, and I was at a conference at the Knight Foundation people in Miami a couple weeks ago talking about this, and the guy from Knight made a very interesting, very chilling point, I think, which was, he said, you know, maybe there'll never be a good business model for journalism again. He said one of the things that we prize most in this society, which is the arts, has a completely broken business model. And it's, we say, one of the things we prize most. The Academy is the same thing. You know, where does the money come from to support the creation and diffusion of knowledge in the Academy? Well, it's a nonprofit model, and these private institutions straight through. So maybe that's where journalism's headed. I'm not saying it's good, but it's working, at least at the moment, in New Haven, although we don't know 5 minutes from now whether this thing will have the money to print, you know, to say.
Well, I actually think it's an interesting model, and I mentioned that one of the things they are talking about is nonprofit foundations taking over newspapers. There was an attempt when the Inquirer went bankrupt for the Pew Foundation to take it over, and they didn't want it. They said no. And it can be complex, as you know, when a big foundation takes over a paper because of ethical conflicts. You know, there was talk about the government becoming involved, which, of course, would be impossible. I mean, there was talk in the White House and among senators that the government has to subsidize newspapers, but that, to me, is not a viable model. There are places where, to some degree, that it's working a little bit. In Minneapolis, there's the Minneapolis, I think it's called the Post, I don't know how good it is, but it is certainly an alternative to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, which went into bankruptcy and got pretty badly decimated by Angelo Gordon, who's a real shark, who was the primary creditor on the Philadelphia Inquirer. That may be a model. I guess the thing I wonder about is because of the way in which we live and because of the speed in which we look at things, whether the net or a computer screen is conducive to reading, you know, a 7, 8, 9, 10,000 word story. That I don't know, but that's, as I say, I don't have all the answers. And if you're reading something, because you know a lot about New Haven, that is credible and better, that is good news. That is good news. You know, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, certainly for me, watching my family read papers, which they did incessantly, had a huge impact. You know, and now I sound very nostalgic, but life was different then. There were only, four television stations, and one was Channel 13, and we never watched Channel 13 because that was PBS.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Now you tell me. But we had less choice. As adults and as kids. You know, kids growing up today, you know, I don't know, cable television, how many stations are there in cable television? There's 700 stations you can get on cable television. And there's absolutely nothing on, that's true. You know, there are all these video games. I mean, that's what we're talking about the iPad today, and there's a lot of ballyhoo paid toward about the iPad and how it's gonna change the book business. That's not why he's coming out with the iPad. He sees by far the biggest market in games. That's where he sees, that's the money pit. It's not in books, it's not in magazines and what they can do and what kind of applications they come up with. It's not newspapers, it's in games. I don't know when it happened. I mean, I don't know. I literally don't know when it happened, but it just sort of happened when I noticed, or we all noticed, the kids just stopped reading the paper. I don't know if it was because of the pace of our lives, because adults were still reading them. I don't know why they stopped caring. I don't know why they saw no use in it, but I think now with the internet just exponentially growing, I think getting them back in the box is gonna be really, really hard. I don't know how to do it. I mean, none of my kids read newspapers, and not even when I have a story. Of course, my wife doesn't either. Now they've both lost, which is interesting. Milton Berle is out too. I mean, television, I didn't even get into television. I mean, I'm sure you read ABC is cutting its news force by 25%. They're eliminating 300 to 400 jobs, and it wasn't like they were doing a great job of running. I mean, what is the average television news segment now? 30 seconds? 45 seconds? 45 seconds to sum up six soldiers getting killed in Afghanistan. I mean, how many here watch the evening news? I mean, it's fascinating sociologically to watch it, because everything is in these bites. There's somehow along the way, who are the purveyors of, whether it's movies, whether it's television, whether it's news, decided we have no attention span left. Look at movies. Go see a Michael Bay movie. Look at how these things are shot. You know, it used to be movie was probably 80 scenes. Movies are now 120 to 150 scenes. No scene should be over a minute. It's all because there's this feeling that we have no attention span left. And yeah, I mean, people did say the same thing about television, and they were right. Television certainly didn't help newspapers. It certainly killed the afternoon paper. And, you know, the internet's going to kill something. And I think it's going to be papers. Sure. That's my cousin. I'm going to introduce everyone as I know.
You touched just for a moment there on the iPad, which I do believe is going to save all these things.
Admit.
Okay, let me just finish with that.
No, good. Good.
It will be the same format as we know it, but it won't be a piece of paper. It will be a laid out page. It will be about journalism. There will be columns. There will be all these things that we love about newspapers. You're going to be able to flip a page. I just saw a demo for Sports Illustrated.
I've seen. But that's, I hear that, I've seen that. That's fantastic. I don't know if anyone's seen it. You can find it online.
You know, someone who does read newspapers.
But I think, I don't know, you can find it online. It's a prototype for something that Sports Illustrated is coming up with that does show what the power of technology can do. It's incredible, down to the ads. I mean, the ads are interactive. The video, the sound, the lights, it is amazing. Now, what I don't know is, do you need your own reader for that, or can that be done on an iPad?
Right now, it's on the iPad. And you know, look, this is going to do, the iPad's going to do publishing, yeah. I believe, what the iPad does.
But I don't think it's, I think it can help books, and I think it can help magazines. I don't think it'll help papers. I just don't, because I think that still, the size of the iPad, it's just different from the tactile feel of holding a paper, because I can do the same thing with the Inquirer now. They have, and there's sites out there and there are web companies that will actually give you the paper, and you can click it on and click the story you want, and it will expand the story. I don't think it's going to help. I just don't think it's going to help papers. I really don't. I think it can help magazines, and I think there will be a better shift from printed books to e-books. But I think for newspapers, it's going to be a very tough road to get the kind of readers that they need to get the kind of revenue.